Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage. A 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet-sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hello and welcome to the Bechdel cast. My name's Jamie Loftus.
And my name's Caitlin Durante.
And this is our podcast in which we discuss the role of women in famous movies you've seen before. Today's a special one. Today's a special one. I mean, you're hearing us on a Tuesday. You don't usually hear us on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
And it's okay. First of all, actually, I'd like to do a PSA right at the tippity.
Okay, the tippity top.
If you're listening to this on election day and you're like, oh, I'm just kicking back listening to the Bechdel cast and you have not yet voted, turn us the fuck off or listen to us on the way. Sorry, I couched it a little.
Yeah, get on your bird scooter. Get in your car. Get on your public transit.
Caitlin knows the youth. Get on your freaking bird,
kids. Get on
kids.
Your feet. You know, whatever mode of transit you want. Just get out there and vote.
Hope you did your research.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Cool. That aside, welcome to the Bechdel cast. If you're not listening to this on election day, sorry for coming in so hot.
But the message rings true. You should always vote every
the
day.
The next opportunity you have.
Yeah, or that.
Do it again.
Mm-hmm. Hey, quick plug at the top of the show. We're going to be doing a live Bechdel cast show here in Los Angeles. So hopefully you live here, but if not, just travel.
No, get with the program.
No big deal.
What
just you know, buy a flight and come on down. But we're doing a show on Saturday, November 10th at 9 p.m. at The Ruby.
This time we'll be covering The Fifth Element.
Ooh, one of my faves.
With our guest and dear friend, Danielle Radford.
Hell yeah. For tickets, go to our website, BechdelCast.com. Click on the live appearances tab, and we will see you there. It's a small venue, so grab your tickets ASAP.
Wow, yes, queen, go off.
Whee!
Okay, so this is our podcast about the portrayal of women in movies. Mm-hmm. We use the Bechdel test as our jumping off point for discussion. Of course, a test invented by cartoonist Alison Bechdel that for our purposes requires that a piece of media has a scene in which two female identifying characters with names talk about something other than a man for two or more lines of dialogue. Shall we demo it?
Yeah, let's demo it. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Caitlin.
Did you vote today?
Yes, bitch, of course I did.
Well, me too.
Wow, we're great.
And we only voted for women, and that passes the Bechdel test.
Oh, okay. I was like, well, but what if some... But also, this still goes. Some female candidates might have some horrible ideas, so it's good to do your research in advance as well.
Darn tootin'.
What a productive Bechdel test passing conversation. So that's where, but we obviously expand the conversation to cover many different topics related to how women are portrayed in the movie. Today, we've got a great movie and a great guest.
Yes, indeed. Let's introduce her.
Let's do it.
She is a producer, writer, actor, and host of the Kinda Dating podcast, yes. Natasha Shandell.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for being here.
You're so funny.
I was just listening to you in the office.
Oh, I hope I said something half decent.
It was an uplifting one.
Okay, good.
It was an uplifting one. Yeah.
Great. Then I take full credit for it.
So we're talking about Election, the movie from 99, director Alexander Payne, adapted from a novel by Tom Perrotta.
I used to have a doctor named Dr. Payne.
Oh.
And I had a dentist named Dr. Vaginis, which is
hilarious.
Which is horrible. Why was my dentist's last name Vagina? We don't know. If Dr. Vaginis gives me a root canal, does that pass the final test? These are the real questions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, Natasha, tell us about your history, your relationship with this movie.
I watched it around when it first came out. I really have a horrible memory, so I won't be the person who ever remembers me watching something in a movie theater. But unless it was Titanic, I 100% remember.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? Titanic.
Yeah. That's the movie you remember watching in a theater. Everything else after that just is gone.
Usually it's
300 episodes.
Usually Jamie.
Let's do another.
And I.
301.
Yeah, let's scratch Election. Yeah. This is a Titanic podcast now. Usually it's one of us to bring up Titanic, and our guest is always like, ugh, why are they talking about Titanic?
Like,
so
yep,
thank
that's a movie.
You.
No, well, I was just going to say we could bring it back to an election because really, if they were to have voted off who should have gotten off that fucking boat, it would not have been half of those people who actually got off.
Can you imagine, like, what a better world it would be if some of those rich motherfuckers had drowned? Hot take.
Yep.
Wow. Yeah.
But and some working class women had survived.
Yes.
Been great.
Anyway.
But yes, I watched Election, again, around when it first came out. I thought it was hilarious. I thought Reese Witherspoon was a great anti-hero. Like, it's the kind of characters I like a lot. Mm. And I'm still not sure. When I watch it again, I'm like, do I like her? Or do I not like her? Like, it's and I love that about her just as an actor. And honestly, like, who thought when that movie came out, was it 97?
99.
That 20-something years or less than 20 years later, I feel like it's the exact thing happening.
It happened
in 2016.
The parallels between this movie and the Clinton-Trump election and campaign are...
There's a lot to unpack there because I think that... I mean, we can get to this in a bit, but I think that Tracy Flick is already partially inspired by Hillary Clinton in this movie, because this is at the end of the Clinton administration. The public is always already well aware that Hillary Clinton has ambitions beyond, well, what was the quote of, you know, making cookies and
right,
like
right.
That.
Also, I have some Wikipedia trivia for us.
Hit it.
That the novel that this movie is based upon, the novel was inspired by two key events. The first one was the 92 Bush v. Clinton election campaign. This, of course, being Bill Clinton and not Hillary, but...
I think that that's when that quote may have first come out, though, of like that she was not going to be your average first lady if he was elected.
And then in that campaign, Ross Perot entered as a third-party candidate, which is echoed in the movie by Tammy Metzler showing up.
Was Tammy Metzler the literal Green Party? Is she like fucking Nader? That's crazy. Whoa, Gary Johnson.
But if you fast forward her now,
she'd
be Trump.
She's the disruptor.
Down.
Right. Like
the
she's...
one who's like, don't do this.
She's not with
I don't care about this. Do you do this? Don't do this.
Yeah,
either
I'm
going to
drain
I'm
the
gonna,
swamp. Yeah, I'm going to get rid of this.
No She's more student body.
Yeah.
Whatever.
So
I was like,
crazy.
Right.
That's what I think I was thinking along those lines, but that totally makes sense that she, I guess in this context, would be third party, like Green Party.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Right.
This movie is crazy. It's so I really liked it.
The other thing that the novel was inspired by was a 1992 incident at a high school in Wisconsin where a pregnant teenager was elected homecoming queen, but the staff announced a different winner and burned the ballots to cover it up.
How horrible.
Fuck that.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
That would so not work in today's social media world.
Oh, absolutely, but in 92,
I'm so mad
pulled it off.
Her.
I mean, thankfully, Homecoming doesn't define our lives.
Yeah.
But speak for yourself.
Well, we just did Carrie, so a lot of lives were altered.
True. Very true.
Caitlin, what's your history with election?
I didn't see it until I think I was in college, so it would have been like the mid-2000s, so not that long after it came out, but certainly not right away. But I remember really enjoying it, but it was one of those movies that I liked, but just was like, okay, I've checked that off my list, move on to the next one on my list, didn't ever go back and revisit it. But I'm kind of bummed that I didn't, because upon rewatching it to prep for this episode, I was like, oh, this is like a really, this is a fun movie. The Tammy character, especially, I am like so here for. And yeah, I enjoy this movie quite a bit.
I saw this movie yesterday for the first time, which listeners of the show will not be shocked to hear. I've only seen the movie Doubt, plus
Titanic,
plus all the movies we've done here, minus The Matrix, which I didn't actually watch, which is so often brought up in our iTunes reviews. If you're leaving us iTunes reviews, I encourage you to mention that as a plus, as a metatextual thing. I saw this movie for the first time yesterday, and I really, really like it. Especially, like, I mean, there's so many great performances in that, but this is the only movie that I've seen anyways of also Matthew Broderick playing like a really despicable guy that you're supposed to hate. But he plays it so, like, I don't know. I really enjoyed his performance, especially. And I just want to talk about how Reese Witherspoon, I think, is like, she's so talented and she's so interesting, where I feel like she's played a character that has kind of the same description every time, but she plays this character so many different ways over the years that it's just like, yeah, like making 50 different recipes out of the same basic ingredients with her. It's so,
including a couple movies that we've covered, which is our most recent episode of Cruel Intentions, where she's like in high school, she's like the virginal,
but she's smart,
you know, like very smart, ambitious young woman going to a private school and then getting tricked into having sex with Ryan Phillippe.
And usually men are like threatened by her.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Elle Woods, of course, on our bonus Matreon episode doing Legally Blonde, kind of a variation on this character, but also entirely different.
All the way up to Big Little Lies, like that was sort of like a, like returning to form a little bit of like, that's a more mature version of the characters she got famous for playing.
Yeah.
She's very interesting to me.
Yes, indeed.
And this movie's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the one thing that really stuck out to me were like, there were so many themes that they talked about through it that, you know, even like right off the top through Matthew Broderick's like narration, the talk of destiny at first, and then they talked about like morals versus ethics, which is like a big one, and then just, you know, how much is too ambitious. It was like so many things that are so relevant.
And the ending, I think, I know that we haven't even done the recap yet, but the ending of this movie, I watched it 4 times because it's just like the movie's firing on all cylinders in like the last 5 minutes, where you know the whole time you're experiencing the movie through unreliable narrators, but it's like in the last couple minutes where Matthew Broderick's narration is still so cocky, and then you see like it's so stark at the end that I wish I had the time to go back and watch the whole thing over with that in mind of like, oh, you can't trust a fucking word that comes out of this guy's mouth for a moment. But I mean, which you know, but like, I can't wait to watch this movie again. It's so good.
Yeah.
So I'll do the recap.
Let's do it.
We meet Tracy Flick, played by Reese Witherspoon, of course. She is in high school. She's an overachiever. She is running for student council president. We meet Mr. McAllister, played by Matthew Broderick. He's a history,
just your everyday guy. Mm-hmm. He likes his wife and he likes his job. He's just a nice kid. Well, it starts out like, it's Matthew Broderick.
Yeah.
You like him, right? He's a teacher this time.
Yeah.
You like that? Probably.
But he seems to be perturbed by Tracy Flick. And then in the backstory, we learn that Tracy had a sexual relationship with another teacher, Mr. Novotny, who got fired, and he moves away. He and Mr. McAllister were best friends.
Locker room talk. We got a whole scene of locker room talk here.
Oh, yeah.
Where we'll talk about this too, but I think the movie's paced so well, and like,
you start to hate Matthew Broderick's character in such specific increments, where you're given a little bit of like, well, he didn't do anything wrong, but he was complicit if something wrong happened, mm-hmm. where he's always the moral high ground, even in that conversation where his best friend's like, I'm having sex with a minor. Mm-hmm. Cool, right? And then Jim, the Matthew Broderick character, says like, well, that's not ethical. Fucking ethics teacher. He's like, well, that's not ethical and that's bad and da-da-da. But he doesn't really do anything about it. Yeah, he just kind of stands by as it happens.
Mm-hmm. He's like, just tell me all the details. Please describe it even further.
And then I'll go watch my creepy VHS porn.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll just tell you that this isn't right, but keep going.
Yeah,
right.
So I can picture everything.
He's like, totally. I don't want to hear that, but secretly we're pretty sure he does. And this is one of the reasons, this relationship between this teacher and student is one of the reasons that Jim McAllister does not like Tracy. And we'll go into other reasons. But so Mr. McAllister doesn't want Tracy to win the student council president. So he approaches Paul, played by Chris Klein.
Chris Klein.
What an interesting jock character. I love this
movie. I can't wait to talk about him.
Such an interesting...
Right. So he's a popular kid. He's, you know, star of the football team.
I kind of love him. He's dumb as rocks. But he's sweet.
That's always his
character too, right?
Yeah, that's kind of his thing. He's so good at it. What's the other? Oh, God. Anyways, I'm going to dig up some other Chris Klein dummy parts.
American Pie.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a big one.
Mm-hmm. So Mr. McAllister gets Paul to run an opposing campaign for president and hopes that Paul will beat Tracy Flick. So Paul starts campaigning, and then we meet Paul's sister, Tammy, who is getting broken up with by this girl, Lisa, who then starts to date Paul. And then to retaliate, Tammy also starts running for student council president.
As Donald Trump, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Where she promises, she's like, I don't care. I just want to do it to bother people. And she's literally like Kanye MAGA hat, like just trolling everyone because she's mad.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because she's running on the platform that student government is stupid. And if she wins, she will dismantle it.
It's just an anarchy platform.
Yeah.
This is giving me chills, guys.
Yeah.
But the people love it. The people are like, yeah, Tammy, you're cool. They love it way more than Paul's campaign because he is a terrible public speaker.
Oh, but that speaker is so good. Hi, my name is Paul.
Who is that equivalent? That's the one I was trying to figure out.
Oh, I think that's like Ted Cruz or something. Mm. Like the guy is like, oh, I'm supposed to inherit
Jeb
this castle.
Bush. It's the Jeb Bush.
That's way more
it's like
point.
You know he was sort of the nicest Bush, and then you're like, okay, there you go.
And so there's even that, right?
There's even almost that like, please clap moment where no one says that aloud, but his like speech ends, there are crickets, and then Mr. McAllister has to be like, yeah.
If only we had found out like almost 20 years later that Please Clap actually came from Election and Jeb Bush loves that movie.
Well, fun fact, according to director Alexander Payne, Election is Obama's favorite political movie.
Interesting.
Really? Oh, mm-hmm. God. I'm sorry, I'm stuck. I haven't thought about Please Clap in a long time.
Ooh, Jeb Bush implored people to clap for him, and that's Clap Facts with Caitlin. Okay. So people are loving Tammy also more than Tracy's campaign because she's just very, you know, bureaucratic, by the book.
She's too prepared.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Tracy is very frustrated and she rips down all of Paul's campaign posters. And then Tammy sees Tracy throwing them away in a dumpster, but Tammy decides to confess to Tracy's crime.
Because that kind of helps her platform, too, of like, yeah, I don't give a fuck. Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the parallel to that is Bernie Sanders.
We're finding the whole fat
I'm just like, I just got to figure out how this is all parallel to everything that's happening.
Fired up.
So meanwhile, Mr. McAllister is falling in love with Mr. Novotny's ex-wife, Linda.
Or he thinks he is.
He thinks he is.
He doesn't know her.
They have sex once, but things very quickly fall apart after that whenever Linda tells Jim's wife, Diane, and then he gets kicked out of the house. And then the next day is election day at the school. The students are casting their votes. The committee is making their count. And then the chairman of this committee, a student named Larry, concludes.
Feminist icon Larry.
Yeah, right? Honestly. He's like really advocating for Tracy because Tracy.
And the truth.
Yeah, wins. The truth. He's, yeah.
Larry's all about the mm-hmm. truth.
Because Tracy wins the election by one vote. And Mr. McAllister cannot allow this to happen.
He goes full Florida, mm-hmm. like Florida 2000.
Oh, yep. Man, the hanging Chad.
The Chads.
He's the Chad.
Damn it.
The hanging Chad.
He pulls two of those Chads off and he throws them away so that it looks like Paul wins the election. Tracy's devastated, but Larry, feminist icon, he's suspicious. So, you know, he apparently goes to investigate. The two ballots that were thrown away are discovered. And then Jim McAllister has to submit his resignation from Carter High.
Which I have so many thoughts about mm-hmm. how the exit system for male teachers work at this school, too.
Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah. We'll get into that.
Mm-hmm.
God.
Also, the side story about him getting it on with while he's lecturing Tracy.
Right. Uh-huh.
He's
trying to preach morals and ethics. And meanwhile,
best friends.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's trying to.
Woman.
Oh, that's so frustrating, too. It's just this movie is so nuts. So that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see something we never see in movies, usually, where it's like he loses his job, he loses his wife. And then we kind of flash forward for the end.
Right, because he starts his life over. He moves to New York City. He gets a job at, like, the Natural History Museum. He is still harboring resentment for Tracy Flick and any.
But he says he doesn't.
Right, he says he doesn't.
He says his life is awesome and he lives in a basement.
But it could not be more clear that he.
$1,500?
Still? No. That was triggering. That was a trigger. I was like,
I used to live in New York. I was like, I remember these times. Very well.
So he still hates Tracy and
he's got a depressed
all Tracy
new girlfriend.
Types.
Yeah.
Even though he would have you believe that his life is great.
Yeah. He actually feels bad for her.
Right.
Yeah.
And we'll talk all about that. But yeah, that's pretty much the end of the film. So let's take a quick break and then we'll come back to discuss.
Woo!
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian Mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. So this story is basically a pathetic man who ruins his life because he resents women
and
is what it boils down to.
All on women.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we see a female high school student who, unlike most high school students in movies, and certainly many that we've talked about recently, she has aspirations beyond wanting to get a boyfriend or beyond wanting to go to prom.
Yeah.
In fact, we don't even know how she feels about prom because she never mentions it. But we do know how she feels about student council because the whole movie is about her wanting to win.
So if we're getting into the Tracy discussion, there's so much about her that is like, I don't know, like unusual and like tricky to unpack in the context of the story, or was for me, where I would argue almost every character in this movie grows and changes very little in the, like their situations change, but they like, I think almost part of the point of the movie is no one really changes.
Yeah.
Where they just kind of continue lying to themselves and others, and that's politics, baby. Like, I get it. But Tracy in particular is interesting because we're introduced with kind of a common shorthand to characterize a female character, which is you put her in a very fucked up, what seems to be a statutory rapey relationship that clearly does, even though it, I think this movie certainly avoids making it the center of her story, but it clearly affects her a lot. And the way this movie plays that storyline is very bizarre. I mean, in terms of the metaphor, I don't know if that's like a politician that has a sex scandal or what that was supposed to symbolize. But in terms of like in this story, it is an adult and a minor. I was a little confused at why it didn't seem to affect Tracy more. If the story's going to go out of its way to be like, here's a statutory rape that happened. And then it does seem like Tracy, to her credit, but also a little bit to my confusion, continued to do everything in high school that she was going to do anyways, almost unhindered by this relationship. I thought that was a little weird. I don't know.
Yeah, I had a hard time kind of processing this component of the story as well, because she, as far as we can tell, as far as the story presents it, she is a willing and consenting participant of this relationship.
This is another place where the voiceover, where you know the voiceover is biased and not necessarily true. But I feel like movies like do this a lot, where she literally says, I know what you're thinking, you know, and it's like, yeah, I know what I'm thinking. You're getting raped by your teacher. And movies almost say, like, by acknowledging it, they get a pass, but it's like, no, that's still what's happening in the movie. But she says, like, I know what you're thinking, and basically says, I was a fully consenting party, don't worry about it, but it, like, the breakup sucked. But it's like,
She almost kind of, it seems like the relationship ends because her mother finds out about it. And
we don't see enough of the mother in this movie either. It's very weird.
True. Yeah. So the mother finds out about it in a scene that happens off screen because we only see the aftermath of it, which is Dave Novotny being very broken up over the relationship ending. We don't
and that's
really
played for laughs too.
Yeah.
We were in love. Like that whole thing is played for, I mean, he's supposed to look pathetic. And he's very clearly, in context of the story, in the wrong. But it just was weird that it fits the tone of the movie. But him looking, like, pathetic and then being like, okay, you got to work at a grocery store. Because when they bring it back later, it's also played for laughs.
Right.
I just didn't like that this rape was continually played for laughs and didn't impact the story really that
much. Right. And then the way that Tracy responds to the relationship and the breakup is that, oh, he had to go and get all mushy. Like,
yeah,
oh, he had to go and
my thing.
Fall in love with me.
Yeah.
I miss our talks, but otherwise, like, what a loser kind of thing. So, yeah, I feel like that's not necessarily the most realistic way in which that type of relationship would play out, especially as it pertains to how it would affect a teen girl.
Right.
Well, also, I think the way that they, my issue was that they made it seem like she, based on her voiceover, that she was consenting and she's like, he didn't do anything. And then clearly in the action, you see he convinced her, like, you know, by playing her emotions and manipulating her. But then at the scenes when they actually start, like, progressing and are having sex, and the moment when she's about to enter the room, she looks scared. And she looks like, oh, my God, I have to do this. Okay.
And he kind of has to pull her into the room.
Yeah.
And then later for her to come back and be like, oh, well, he caught feeling. It was like, huh? Right. I was like, I thought you were, I'm confused.
That was why I was like, oh, I want to watch the movie over knowing that all the voiceover are lies. Because I guess now understanding that a little better, it's like, oh, all that voiceover was not true necessarily, because we see her being coerced. And I think the movie understands that, but it just like it just wasn't clear because it's so early in the movie. Where
And then even at the end, her final scene, though, when she sees the teacher character again, she's like a young politician or something, and she's getting in a car with some senior male politician, and her look is almost like, am I fucking him? And you're just like, wait, are you, what? What is he? Because it was sort of like the teacher insinuating it in a little bit. With that, I thought.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that. That's totally possible. Yeah.
I don't know. Crazy. That's where I was like, is he trying to say that she's like using somebody again? Or, you know.
Well, because it seems, and this is certainly how Jim McAllister perceives her, and I think how you can definitely interpret this as that she'll kind of stop at nothing to get ahead. And if that means, you know, sleeping her way to the top, I feel like the movie is suggesting that that's a definite possibility for her.
Yeah, that, I mean, that side of it, I think that there, it's not even like that needed to be written out of the story entirely. It just felt like that was one of the few subplots of this movie that just like wasn't handled responsibly or satirically enough.
Right.
Or there was just something about it that just really bothered me. Because
it's not like the teacher she was messing with, like, did he add something to her life that...
I think it's more for Jim than... If that storyline affects Jim more than it does her, because that opens up that guy's ex-wife and sets the precedent that, like, Jim is, like, this complicit kind of two-faced guy.
It's just weird that they used her as the as the catalyst for that. Like, she's the bad one when she was the kid getting...
And right. Jim resents... I mean, and I think that Jim secretly resents Tracy because now he doesn't work with his friend anymore.
Yeah.
That was
To me, that's the main reason, why this is in the story, because he needs a reason. I mean, it's very clear that he does not respect women and he is very threatened. And
he talks his way around it for so long, though. Yeah. He's like, I don't blame Tracy, and then spends the rest of the movie blaming
her. Yeah. So to me, the reason that this part of the story exists in the movie is that he needs a compelling, I guess, reason that he really actively resents her and has to like it motivates him to retaliate. But I feel like by making it a situation where she is the victim of statutory rape is a weird choice. And it's, I mean, like we see in many movies, it is directed by a man, co-written by two men, and adapted from a novel written by a man. So
right. So we're 3 degrees of separation away from, I mean, we're a million degrees because no one was talked to. Not to get too stuck on this point because there's so much to talk about, but there was just the way that relationship was portrayed. There was one scene especially that like made my heart hurt a little bit, because I feel like there's like a lot of girls who in high school, like, even if it's not the extent of that experience, there's like a teacher who talks to you some kind of way and goes out of their way to make you feel special. And then you look back on it and you're like, wait a second, that was you. I literally had an art teacher who would always be very complimentary of all the girls, and then after school would be like, you should chug a bottle of cough syrup and like come back tomorrow and tell me what you did. And you see, I mean, people wonder why women, particularly young women, have like this eternal fraud syndrome. And I think this is like a very concise, the way that scene plays out, I thought was like effective to the point of being a little painful to watch, where, you know, it's like, here's this older man who Tracy clearly has a lot of respect for, and she's a crush on him, whatever. And he tells her she's smart, she's special, she's attractive, and then it's just like this coercion thing.
It's basically the same speech that Jack gives Rose in Titanic, where he's like, you're the most outstandingly wonderful.
But it's not, because he means it.
Right.
And they're in love.
But it's that keyword, they're in love.
It hits the same beats, because he's like, you're the most wonderful, astounding woman I've ever known. And then Dave Novotny is like, you're the most smart, sensitive, attractive student person
human
I've
being.
Ever met.
Yeah. Oh, I hate it. Yeah. It just, that is so, like, if there's a one scene in a movie I've seen in the past couple of years that concisely puts, like, why do all actually smart, talented women have this kind of fraud syndrome. It's like maybe because men say that just to fuck them, mm-hmm. and then they feel like it's not true because someone just said it so that they could fuck
them. I'll just add the tiniest point because, mm-hmm. again, I don't want to stay on this too long, I'm sure. Oh, yeah. But when Jim
McCann, yeah.
when he talks about like why he's upset, the first cut is to the Dave guy saying like her pussy gets so wet or something. Like,
yeah.
And then you're like, oh, wait a minute. Is he talking about this kid? And then with this whole Kavanaugh thing happening, the headline has been, you know, Trump says it's dangerous to be a young man right now. And I was like, is it dangerous to be a young man right now? Mm-hmm. I'm like, interesting. Well, welcome to our life for all of time.
Right. Yeah, it's like, if
it's
so
dangerous
welcome.
To be a woman at all times in all of history and eternity.
Uh-huh. One more point about this, where there is such heavy, and I was annoyed about it until, again, the very end, where I'm like, there's so much voiceover in this movie. But voiceover is used to introduce the characters as well. Another movie where that happens that we did not too long ago is Royal Tenenbaums.
Mm.
And there was a tendency in those movies where the male characters were introduced in voiceover with their accomplishments and the women were introduced with their sexual history.
Oh, yes.
I didn't notice that.
This movie doesn't quite do that. It was almost an inversion of it, where Tracy Flick is introduced with her accomplishments.
And she's introducing herself.
Yes. And then there's a sudden flip where it's like, and here's the other stuff. I guess I don't feel any which way about it, but it just reminded me, mm-hmm. of at very least many facets of her life were presented. And mm-hmm. it wasn't like, here's the girl and here's who she fucked.
Right.
Yeah.
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 There's some of that, but it's not exclusively that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk a little bit about how Jim McAllister views women. It is very clear, especially as the story goes on, that he feels extremely threatened by strong, smart, ambitious women. He says in his voiceover toward the beginning that he does not blame Tracy for what happened with Dave. How could I? Dave was an adult over twice her age. Sure, she got on my nerves once in a while, but I admired Tracy. I really did. And as he's saying that, he's like throwing away the signatures that she got to be able to campaign for president. And it's obvious that he does not admire her, that he does blame her and resent her for the situation with Novotny being fired. But he places none of the blame on him, and he places all of the blame on Tracy.
Yeah, I mean, Jim, the way I interpreted that character was like a demonstration of like, here's the most average guy in the world who at the beginning of the movie, you know, he's average as fuck. He seems relatively content-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's peel back even in the most average of people is this deep-seated hatred of certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And then, it goes up to a fucking 11 from there. But it's because he is so average.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Hates women, and he doesn't think he hates women.
Mm-mm.
And that, I think, is a lot of guys.
And Tracy points that out too, right? In her voiceover says that, I mean, I would hate my life if I were him. And
yeah,
just like, yeah, the monotony of what he does, yeah, all the time. And she, in her depiction, was like on every student body, like
every
team. And yeah, yeah, exactly. She was like in the front of everything. And
it's kind of hard to know, I guess, because this was, and because it's so steeped in politics, like the Monica Lewinsky scandal is a few years before this.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost hard to know exactly how the writers of this movie want these lines to come off, which is interesting. I mean, I'd be interested in hearing what Alexander Payne thought in 99 versus now, because I think the reading of this movie is very open to interpretation,
mm-hmm.
in a good way, where you can, mm-hmm. kind of see what you want in it. But there, really quick, I want to go back to my buddy, feminist icon Roger Ebert, who almost always has the worst take and the most stupid. Like, everyone's like, he was the best, but go back and read his stuff. He wasn't. His summary of the movie is so telling, where he gave it a good review, but he says, here's a movie that's not simply about an obnoxious student,
yeah,
but also about an imperfect teacher, a difficult administration, and a student body that's mostly just marking time until it can go out into the world and occupy valuable space. That, wow, is his. So all that to say, the reading of this movie in the 20 years after is probably changed a lot.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
The next thing I want to say about Jim McAllister and how he views women, specifically Tracy Flick, is that not only does he resent her for, you know, his best friend getting fired, and not only does he feel threatened by her ambitiousness, he has a bunch of sexual fantasies about her.
Mm-hmm. Well, he has a lot of sexual fantasies about a lot of people.
Yes.
Every woman who's not his wife.
Yeah. Every woman except the woman who loves him.
Well, is it anyone else besides Linda? Because I feel Linda and Tracy. It's
Linda, Tracy, and then he watches porn.
And it was also like a teacher-student porn.
Yes.
Oh, was it? I thought it was a football player and cheerleader, that they were both students.
And then he projects Dave onto
it. That's what I thought it was. Yeah.
It is mostly Tracy and Linda who he takes stuff out on. But even based on, there's like a few shots, and I kind of want to compare this shot later on to a shot we see of Tammy versus a shot of Jim, because those characters balance each other out in this very bizarre way. Mm-hmm. But there's a few shots where we see Jim's direct viewpoint. So, you know, some male gazey shit. Mm-hmm. Some of it's more obvious where that time, you know, like you see that shot of like Linda's boobs.
Oh, yeah. He's like hanging a fruit.
She's framed sexually. Mm-hmm. His wife is not framed sexually.
Right.
Even during sex scenes, she's not framed sexually. And then anytime Jim's voiceover is going and we get those really unflattering shots of Tracy. So the visual language is telling you how Jim feels about the women around him.
Yeah. And then he's the type of person that after that day that he spends with Linda, you know, he takes her to the mall to go shopping and is like helping her out around her house. He's like driving her back, and then they see like a motel on the side of the road, and he's like, should we get a room? And she's like, that's not funny. So he's like making a sexual advance. She rejects it. And then when he's back home and talking to his wife, she's like,
His wife.
She's like, how was your day? And he's like, oh, you know, Linda's great, but she can be a little much sometimes. Mm-hmm. So he's the type who, when his advances are like rebuffed and rejected by a woman, he
starts talking shit.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he's a feminist icon.
This is the same year American Beauty comes out, I'm pretty sure, that also came out in 99. There are a few parallel. I like this movie a million times more than I like American Beauty. I can't stand that movie.
Yeah.
But there are a few like recognizable qualities in him and then Kevin Spacey's character in that movie, where the small like micro punishments of the women around them when he feels reduced or rejected or just in that line about Linda is so great, because I'm like, oh, I can picture almost any guy I know saying something about someone else that way and not even having it barely register.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Without getting personal, but one of my exes, who I've often talked about on my podcast, crazy one, we'll just go with that. when he was cheating on me, he would talk about the girl he was cheating on me with, but he would keep saying like shitty things about her.
Oh,
and like always being like, she was blah, 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 blah.
That's probably a telltale sign that someone's 100%. Cheating on you.
And I didn't even know that they were friends. Yeah. And then when I found out, I was like, huh? And I was like, wait, so all this time.
I had a guy do that too. Fuck, man.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you know.
I was out trying to throw you off the scent. And sometimes it fucking works.
Yeah. Another fun thing happens where later on, when Jim McAllister ruins his own life by cheating on his wife, he calls Linda and blames her for ruining his life. So he is the type of person who's not willing to accept any blame or to take accountability for anything that he's done. He's always looking for other people to pass the blame on to, or he's resenting everyone else for things that he is complicit in, or that other people have done wrong.
I think almost at the top of that is like any woman exerting power over him, he's gonna retaliate against. Because part of the reason I thought he wasn't even being affectionate towards his wife, even though, you know, she certainly didn't do anything wrong, was because she really wanted a baby. And that, like, almost like, first of all, that's lazy writing for his wife kind of character. But
also just like the fact that he wasn't the primary focus of her desire, I think is a pretty clear reason why he'd want to retaliate against her. He wants to be the center of everything. And he's so threatened. And this is like fucking pathetic. He's so threatened by Tracy wanting to be student body president that he rigs an election where there's that line where he's like, the sight of Tracy at that moment affected me in a way I can't explain. Who knew how high she'd climb in life? How many people would have to suffer because of her? I had to stop her now. Like, he's so afraid of female power in any way that he, and it just gets so pathetic, and I love when he gets stung by a bee. Okay.
And just like the fact that like he's saying like how many people would she affect in her life, and right. It's like while you know you stay quiet while your best friend was fucking a minor, and her life is ruined, his life is ruined, the wife's life is ruined, your wife's life is ruined, your baby's life is ruined. Paul's life is ruined.
Poor Paul.
Poor Paul.
Well, also, his wife never gets pregnant, right?
His wife. Not that we see in the story.
I think that that's another thing. Like, he's impotent. I think that that was like what that message. Yeah. They were having baby sex every night and he...
Yeah, they were trying for a year and never conceived.
He's an impotent man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hey, let's take a quick break and then we'll be back for more.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Ooh. I just wanted to read some quick stats about women in politics, and then we can, talk about some more specific characters. Let's just use Congress as an example, a little microcosm of politics, if you will. Well,
tell me more about this Congress.
In 2018, the year that we are currently living in, unless you are listening to this podcast from, 2194, because this podcast is going to last
forever and ever.
Yes, and really hold up, too.
Yeah, this will be the last thing people hear before they die.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this podcast, you do have 7 days to live.
Okay, so in 2018, there are 107 women in Congress, making up only 20% of members of Congress.
Hot.
In 1999, the year that this movie comes out, there were only 63 women in Congress. 100 years ago, guess how many women were in Congress?
We couldn't vote, so.
There was one.
None?
There was one.
There was one
in Congress when we couldn't fucking vote.
How did that happen?
Who was that?
Yeah, I don't know. I need to do more research.
Shake her dead hand.
But Rutgers.edu gave me some hot info.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, Rutgers.
So,
all right, Rutgers.
Much like in movies, women are wildly underrepresented in politics, too. Wouldn't you know it?
Except if you're listening to this right now, a record number of women are running for political positions this year, midterms, today. Go out and vote right now.
Yeah. Also, if you combine movies and politics, two things that are so good to women historically, the results are even worse. A quick Google search of political movies will yield results that show nearly every movie in that sort of subgenre of political movies is about men. Except for that Sarah Palin movie, Game Changer, and maybe a few other kind of wild cards here and there.
Is awesome and rules.
I have not seen that movie.
Say the one time we're ever like Sarah Palin fucking.
Literally.
She's awesome. Her movie was just about her.
I loved her talk show about moose or whatever.
very ironic.
That was literally what it was. It was like Sarah Palin goes to the woods and Frenches a moose. Remember where she could have been a heartbeat away from the presidency, whatever. I don't know. That's almost one of those like ripple effects things where if you're basing movies on real life events, it would be really hard to make movies about women.
Mm-hmm.
But only if you are making movies about very high level politicians. Like where's the hidden figures of women working in like women doing the actual work while Mr. Guy is wearing his Mr. suit and he's like, that was me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like one of those things where it's like, yeah, it's like hard to find. You have to really look for those stories. And people should.
But if there were more movies about women in politics, little girls could have seen them and said, hey, I see myself represented on screen.
I agree.
That's going to influence my decision to go into politics.
Yeah,
but because there was not the representation, it perpetuates the cycle.
Right. And this movie, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, just based on that Ebert review alone, I think that people's view of Tracy tends to be all over the place, and I was sort of having trouble placing how the movie feels about her at times.
Mm-hmm. Same.
And I think that is intentional I don't even think the movie's totally okay with female power, and I think that the movie wants you to feel like she's kind of annoying and she's overly ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
I don't read that character that way at all, but it seems like just based on the time this movie came out, and listeners, if you have any opinions or more information, please let us know. But it seems like this character, to an extent, I mean, down to the way she's styled, is supposed to be a Hillary Clinton style character, where from so early to her being in the public eye, whether you like her or dislike her, whatever, we're not even going to get into that. But she was portrayed from moment one as a power-hungry woman whose very existence was emasculating her male counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
And like almost no matter what side, whether you were on the left or the right or whatever, that was the general view, was that she wanted too much. She was trying to be too powerful. And it seems like that is supposed to be the exact same values that we see in Tracy, even though with the benefit of time, there's so much more there, but it was, I don't know, it just seems like a weird inconclusive commentary on something that I'm like, I don't know how Alexander Payne feels about her.
Right.
I think he likes her, but thinks she's annoying and should go away.
Right. And then, but there's some moments where Tracy expresses different frustrations about, you know, working really hard for something and saying stuff that really resonated with me, where she says, she's talking about her mom. She says she likes to write letters to successful women like Elizabeth Dole and Connie Chung and ask them how they got to be where they are and what advice they have for me, Tracy, her daughter. 9 times out of 10, they say you have to hold on to your dreams no matter what. The pressures women face mean you have to work twice as hard, and you can't let anything or anyone one stand in your way. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, it's like, yeah, she's seems like she's willing to kind of like trample on some people to climb her way to the top. But yeah. And on the other hand, she's saying, yeah, like as a woman, she has to work twice as hard, gets not nearly as much of the recognition. And, you know, it's always an uphill battle for her. Yeah.
Well, it was also such a mirror again of the 2016 election where it was clearly out of the two final candidates, the more experienced one who had less of a personality, but more, you know what I mean, in terms of a magnanimous kind of thing.
Came off as a little bit cold.
Yeah, cold and, you know, the not as personable the way people perceived it. And then the other person, far less qualified, but this big person who spoke in layman language and used, you know, short words and descriptions for everything that related to a lot of people.
He reminded me of George W. Bush a few times, where it was just like he's simple and he'll do what he's told.
That's such a big part of elections nowadays, right? It's like, is it about the quality of the candidate and their policies and their experience, or is it personality? Is
this like, who do you want to get a beer with?
Yeah, like, I don't want to get a beer with a political candidate. Yeah. Please give me the best policies.
Right.
And then do your job. Don't drink with me. Don't come to the cha-cha lounge with me, senators. Go to work.
Exactly.
And then Tracy expresses this very sentiment in a fairly long monologue that I will paraphrase, but basically she's saying, you know, you might think I'm upset that Paul Metzler decided to run. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have the qualifications that I do. Yeah, it sucks that some people are just handed everything to them. And while other people like me who've worked very, very hard for their entire lives, you know, trying to get what they want, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, doesn't bother me at all. And obviously it does, because every person who delivers any sort of voiceover narration in this movie is not unreliable.
Lying to themselves and others.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure that resonated with all of us.
Yeah.
Like, hearing that. And the reason, I guess the reason I say it, because it's weird, because stuff like that is so clearly written where you're like, whoever's writing this story must, you know, feel for Tracy and at least to some extent understand her. But then where that character is left, like you were saying a little earlier, Natasha, is like it's a little bit weird where the last line I think we hear her speak is like when she's at college, and she's still the implication at the end of like, because she is intelligent and has ambitions, that she will be alone forever, was a weird place to leave that character, because that's one of the few moments where, you know, in the voiceover, she's like, and it's totally fine. And that's the lie. But you see reflected in the voiceover and what happens, that's what the movie thinks happens to her, is that she doesn't really have friends in high school. And people point that out to her a few times. Mm-hmm. And it clearly does affect her in small ways. And then we see her flash forward to college, and there's that voiceover line, if you want to be great, you've got to be lonely. And we see her alone. And it's just like such a weird, I was like, then how do you feel about this woman movie? Because that is, you know, not necessarily true. It's not, I mean, it seems like it's like, this is the truth for this kind of woman. And I mean, my guess would be that the writer, whoever, at what point in the like line of men that wrote this movie, that must have been something that felt true to them, because it's presented like it's true.
Well, can I say, so we've done two episodes of this on our podcast. That we did one on the science of relationships and another one with the author of a book called The Love Gap, of why smart women are single.
That's the one I was listening to.
Yeah. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. And I think in that one, she references the psychologist from Science of Relationships who was on our podcast. And they talk about their case studies that say, and I'm going to fuck up the ratio or the percentage, but a large percentage, like if you ask guys, what kind of woman do you want? Like 80% of them say they want a smart, independent, ambitious woman who like can think on her own, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it's like less than 57% or something like that. 57% of guys actually end up with a dependent woman and they don't actually end up with the independent woman. And so this is a whole book and case study around the fact that like, theoretically, you love the idea of this, but when you're actually faced with this person, they make you feel less than.
Yeah.
Which is like the Jim McAllister character, right?
Right.
Like he felt whenever he was around somebody like Tracy, a reminder that he is living this monotonous life when she chose to take steps to, you know.
Yeah. And there's that line that he has in the very end whenever he talks, when he's seeing her in Washington, D.C., and he says something like, oh, I feel sorry for her. She's probably still waking up at 5 a.m. every day pursuing her stupid little dreams. And it's like...
And he's like holding a fucking Slurpee cup. No disrespect. But, you know, I love Slurpee Nation. But he's out there, you know, denigrating the visual of holding a Slurpee cup.
As like a 45-year-old dude, living in a basement in New York.
But like, you know, he looks so pathetic. And then he throws the Slurpee at the limo. He's like, I'm so mad. Me. I volunteer. I'm a docent. And he's got this like clinically depressed new girlfriend who's like she's recently out of her relationship, and he in that shot, I don't know if you notice, she's talking about something and he stares at her tits, and so he unchanged. It's so like fuck this guy, but there's millions of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and we know some of them.
Yeah, so as far as Tracy goes, I liked her as a character quite a bit. I identified with her because I feel like I was not exactly like her in high school, but I was like way too ambitious and taking things way too seriously. And like my thing was like, I want to graduate in the top 5% of my class. And like I was, you know, I was doing mock trial. I was, you know, playing the sports and doing all the stuff.
Pay for VHS of you doing mock trial.
So I, you know, related to her, and there were some moments in high school where I also like felt like a loner because I was like, man, no one's taking their studies as serious as me, so I can't let these people slow me down. And like, in any case, this is all to say that I generally like the way that she's written, and I find her to be, you know, a fairly multi-dimensional, interesting character.
For sure.
We often don't see that, especially in, you know, kind of teen high school movies like this.
There's just a few blind spots.
Exactly.
Me. Yeah.
For sure.
One of the blind spots that, I don't know if it's a timing thing, but I feel like we're kind of set up like Tracy's mom is going to be an important character in this story, but then she never really becomes that. Like, she only actually speaks and I think, like, one scene, which is weird because she's introduced in voiceover as like, my mom is awesome. She raised me on her own. She contacts powerful women. She's like, supports me.
She's a paralegal. You know, we know what she does for a living.
And then the lazy writing of like, I know what you're thinking. I grew up without a dad, so I hate men. And it's like, okay, this is horrible writing. Why are we doing this? But then the mom character, there's blind spots there too, because the mom gets so mad. She finds out that, you know, like her daughter's being taken advantage of, to say the least, by her own teacher, but then doesn't demand something beyond him being fired. Like, there's just a few weird, like,
sure.
If that were my, like, a mom that seems as on it as this mom is presented to be, she would be trying to get this dude in fucking jail. He would not be working at a grocery store.
Well, maybe she did.
She did try to sue Jim.
She did.
Oh.
At the end, they had like the newspaper that said that she, but not Dave, the one who actually assaulted
him. Well, maybe it's daughter. Commentary on how when women come forward about, you know, abuse and assault, there's no consequences. Yeah. Nothing happens. But it's, I don't think it's active commentary on
definitely
that. But
yeah, it's weird. When I first watched the movie, I'll be honest, I didn't like Tracy when I was young.
Sure.
And I didn't know enough. And I was like, she's just not nice. And I like the nice guy. And the nice guy should have won. And I can't believe. And then as I've grown older and become more, obviously, grown and matured in my own. And, and though I've always been ambitious, I think the part of her that was very, like, I would do anything to get there part never related to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I sort of blacklisted her in that way. And this time when I watched her, I really appreciated the passion she had and you know, her actually not getting brought down by the stupid teacher who did this horrible thing to her, but to like not have lost all of her zeal for it. Like, I appreciated that part. And like, I mean, at the end, even when she lost for a second, she was like, okay, Like
she accepted defeat. Yeah. She cries a lot, but yeah, you know,
a purple pantsuit the whole bit. Yeah. The world wept. It was a tough morning for everyone.
Even though she did, she won the popular vote, but that damn electoral college.
Yeah. Man. That's an excellent point. I mean, for any listener who hasn't seen this movie in a while, particularly since the last election, probably go back and watch it and see how your opinions of the characters have changed. Because especially if you saw it when it first came out, chances are your brain has been scrambled upwards.
Certainly.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Tammy and the queerness that's represented on the screen.
Yes.
Because when we first are introduced to Tammy Metzler, she and Lisa are kissing. Lisa's not really into it. She leaves, and then we hear Tammy's voiceover, which is that it's not like I'm a lesbian or anything. I'm attracted to the person. It's just that all the people I've ever been attracted to happen to be girls.
She's struggling with coming out of the closet.
Figuring it out.
Yeah, I really liked Tammy. I appreciated her whole, like, anarchy thing, where obviously that doesn't translate well into, like, current politics or, like, our actual situation. But as, you know, as a high school student body, where what even is, in my school at least, like, the student body government got nothing accomplished, like, didn't do anything. It was really just a title and a popularity contest, and that was it. So I like that she recognizes that. I like that she advocates for herself. She stands up for herself. She does call Tracy a cunt.
Tammy's kind of a mixed bag for me, I'll be honest. It is so rare, I mean, especially in a movie of this time, to see any queer representation in a teen movie. As we kind of know, based on, I mean, a lot of movies we've been doing recently are teen movies of this era, and you very rarely see a fleshed out queer character who we know something about them other than they're queer.
Right.
But a lot of, I mean, it's, there are some really good moments that she has, and then there's other stuff that it's like, ooh, really? This is the... this movie, first of all, has no recognition of bisexuality. It's a very simplistic view of even... I mean, that line that you just said, that, like, I fall in love with the person, could be interpreted to be kind of a forward-thinking, you know, there's like a statement of, like, not recognizing the binary in that way. But the way we're supposed to read it is that she is, strictly attracted to women and just doesn't want to admit it to herself or isn't ready. The fact that she only enters the race for revenge against another woman who I don't totally understand. The Lisa character was very confusing to me of, like, why is Lisa retaliating against Tammy so hard if we are supposed to believe that she is not queer in any way?
Lisa's motivations are not clear, well-defined, or explained at all.
The only thing you hear is Paul's like, and then Lisa just came over and gave me a blowjob. And you're like, huh?
Yeah.
I was like, what? But I mean, the only way I pieced it together was she was using Tammy to get to her brother, but they should have just added some line in that, like, that's what she was doing and was, like, sort of experimenting with her and was like, nah, I'm not really into this. I'm really actually into your
brother.
But
then she gets so into running Paul's campaign.
That's the thing.
I'm like, maybe there's some political reference I'm not getting in this. Like, there was, for every character that confused me, I'm like, maybe this is a reference to a 90s politician that I just, like, am not as aware of. But the fact that Tammy enters the race as kind of like a Trumpy rogue candidate that's like, burn it all down because I want to get revenge against someone. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, what else do we got, Tammy? Like, what else? And we see scenes where she's stalking Lisa. And
she
is stalking for love, hiding in trash cans, the whole fucking montage we've seen a million times. I was like, okay, what else we got, Tammy? And he calls, I forget if it's Tracy a bitch, Lisa a cunt, Tracy a cunt, Lisa a bitch. That exchange is made, and then you're like, okay, it's not like women aren't allowed to dislike other women. What else do we got? And the one scene with Tammy, a character that I do genuinely like, and to seeing, like, representation and her being there is powerful in itself. But the way the movie treats the character and the choices that she makes, I feel like villainizes her in a way that's not necessary.
True.
The one moment I really liked of hers that to me almost stands in like direct opposition to the way we see Jim all the time is that scene where I forget what motivates her leaving the house. I think it's when like Tammy finds out she has to go to Catholic school or something. She's going to have to drop out of the election and she sees a soccer field full of girls and she's looking at them. And so it is a gazy shot, but it's not an exploitative shot where there's like she's standing far away and she's looking, you know, and you can tell like she's interested and possibly attracted, but it's not creepy.
Right.
And it's, and then you see anytime Jim looks at a woman, it's very creepy and cropped and whatever. And I was like, that was my favorite scene with Tammy where you saw like, that felt like, I mean, I'd be interested in what our listeners think. That felt like the closest thing to like positive, progressive representation of just like a girl recognizing her own sexuality and, you know, being semi-okay with it. But I feel like that character is weird in a lot of ways.
Well, she's just as kind of, it seems, as unreliable of a narrator as everyone else where, you know, she at the end, she goes to Catholic school and she meets another girl whose name I forget, but there's
Jennifer.
A little... All right, Juniper, right, where she's like, we're soulmates and we're never going to be apart and we're, you know, best friends and we love each other. And you can kind of imagine that that story will play out a very similar way as her relationship with Lisa, because she keeps, seems like she's kind of chasing after girls who may be open to experimenting or who may be questioning, but ultimately end up, you know, identifying as hetero.
And that, like, lines her up with all the other characters who basically end where they started at the end of the movie, too.
Yeah.
Where it's like...
This could have been an opportunity for her to, you know, learn and grow, but she simply does not.
The only thing I felt with, like, the three candidates was the girls all seem angsty. And, like, the one Paul guy is just so cool and laid back. And he's just, like, wants to be this cool dude. And, like, man, I just became homecoming king. And everybody loves me. And, you know, Lisa went off to find somebody else. But I guess that's life. Like, he's so cool. And, like, the girls are, like, she's, like, the angsty lesbian trying to figure her life out. And I'm, like, why is it... Like, her whole thing is, like, anger. And,
But then he also turns to camera at the end, and he's like, maybe my life would have been different. And he's like, or maybe I'd be dead. And it's like, what?
Why did they choose to break the fourth wall there?
Yeah.
Because he's so the weird. Only person that does that, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know if that line even, like, made sense. That
character?
There's some, like, cognitive dissonance there. I don't know.
There's a whole other movie in that line. I was like, is he secretly very deep and, like, nihilistic and thinks that he's going to die?
Yeah.
I totally see your point of Tammy is just as fucked up as anyone in the movie. I guess it's just the main person we have to compare her to is Tracy, who is not as... conniving. She is, I think, just as frustrated and angry, but I think it just gets back to the problem of, like, well, because Tammy is the only queer character we see represented, everything she does, it's almost hard to keep it individual because queer people are never represented. And so when you do see, like, the one queer character doing all these, like, this petty bullshit, you're like, oh, man.
It's dangerous. I guess I just, like, looking at it on the surface and not analyzing her character any deeper than that, like what we've just done, but just kind of on very surface level, like her speech that she gives and then the scene where she's like praying and saying like, hey, God, I know I don't believe in you, but I'm going to Catholic school soon. So like, I guess I better practice. And then, you know, her speech is all like, who cares? Like, I don't even want to be running for this. You know, I'm just going to dismantle this institution and, like, don't vote. I don't care. And I was just like, oh, she's
today
cool.
You should vote.
Right. Don't listen to Tammy. You should vote and you should care.
And your vote counts.
Can we talk about Paul?
We got to talk about Paul.
Just gotta
where to begin with Paul?
Well, you can start by saying that he, unlike many jock football player type characters that we see in teen movies, he is not this like gross misogynist toxic masculinity poster child.
Paul's a blank slate, dude.
He's sweet and he's sensitive and he like loves his sister and he like is originally opposed to running against Tracy and her, and he's like, I'm not gonna run against her, you know, that's, she's good at that and I'm not gonna, you know, interfere. And there's a few lines where he approaches his sister Tammy, he says, yeah, it's kind of weird that you're running against me and you haven't told me why you're doing it, but that's okay, I respect your privacy and I want you to know whoever wins, you or me, there's no hard feelings, we're still brother and sister.
Oh, also the weird addition, like that weird moment where he's like, well, you are adopted. I was like, why is that there?
That's right.
Yeah. It's like, I guess that's just another thing we know.
Yeah. And then, you know, when he's praying for her, he's asking God to make Tammy happier because she's so smart and sensitive and I love her so much. Like,
but then also he's clueless because he doesn't seem to realize that his sister is queer. Mm-hmm. There's like some moments where I was like, Paul, you missed that?
And he's like, and I don't know what, how Lisa ended up here. I mean, she got in a fight with Tammy and next thing I know she's on my dick.
Right. I was like, Paul, read the room.
Yeah, so he's just clueless and stupid. And then also a line that he delivers, I think in voiceover pretty early on in the movie, he says, you know, Mr. McAllister changed my life and whatever they say he did or didn't do, I believe he's a good man. So he almost just like sees the good in people to a fault.
Mm-hmm. Because he's never, like, it's sort of like that, you know, there's guys out there like this who are, you know, they have a good heart. They mean the best. They're generally respectful of women, but nothing bad has ever really happened to them. And so they're not going to assume that anyone would do anything against anyone's better interest because they just don't have that experience.
Right.
I mean, the one thing that he did that was very poignant was at the end when they were voting. He's like, I know everybody says that you should vote for yourself, but I don't think that that's the right thing to do.
So he literally was the one who voted Tracy in. Yes. She won by Paul's vote.
Yep.
Oh, he's a good guy.
And then he wants to have a carnival that fundraises for muscular dystrophy at the end.
That scene kind of broke my heart, too, of like, he does end up caring. Like, you know, and that's supposed to be like a funny moment where Mr. McAllister's stooge ends up being motivated and does want to make a difference. But you're like, man, that like seems like pretty true to how, you know, like when men usually only choose to support younger versions of themselves and bring them in and it just perpetuates this. Oh, God, that whole scene was like, oh, Paul. Baby.
Paul won't drop the ball. That was one of his his campaign slogan.
It's a little defensive, but I like it.
Another one was, Paul Metzler, you Betzler.
Precious.
But, this is just a quick thing, and we hardly know anything about this character, but the student who is running for vice president, Jerry, we see representation on screen of a person with a disability.
I love Jerry, and he's running unappose.
Unopposed. He cracks jokes. He's
writes
funny.
Writes a speech anyways.
Yeah.
Jerry basically gets a standing O.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he says something like, I can't stand, but I stand for you. And everyone's like, that's our Jerry. Another character we see for like 2 seconds that I was like, ooh, there's a whole other thing in there. Tammy's mom. There's that scene where the parents find out that she's been election tampering and she's been disrupting.
Yeah.
You know, coming down the escalator with Melania and the whole shit. but there's a scene with the parents where it seems pretty pointed. The mom's sitting there like with a martini. I think she's supposed to be like a wine mom who is exhausted with her blowhard husband. And he's, you know, yelling. He's like, rah, 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 you suck and you're going to a new school. And Tammy's mom keeps almost saying something and then is cut off. And then eventually she finally does say something and is, you know, not a dumb person at all, is very well spoken and starts to make a cogent point, and then the dad cuts her off again.
Yeah, just like interrupts her. You're going to Sacred Heart or whatever
the
school is.
You're just like, whoa.
Oh, they say something like, yeah, we're going to straighten you out. And then she's like giggling because I don't know if it's because of like.
Yeah, right.
Like, no one's going to straighten me. Yes. I'm pansexual, you idiot.
Good try.
And it's like, all right, Tammy. We okay.
Does anyone have any other thoughts about the film?
Oof, there's a lot. Oh, just the last a shot I really liked was the shot of the dick. At the end, where he's like, what happens when a man loses everything? It's like literally a straight-up castration shot.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess the last thing I wanted to say in terms of just, like, you know, unwrapping a pretty clear commentary is the idea of second chances, where Jim's character at the end, you know, is like, and then I moved to New York and I got to start. And it's not perfect. Clearly, his life kind of sucks. But... you know, he's not really punished. He just has to start over.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, a clear political allegory of like, hey, just, I mean, I think applies to what a lot of guys are trying to do after their Me Too moment, too, of like, I just got to go somewhere else or wait a little while and then I can just keep on doing that.
You know how Louis C.K. keeps doing drop-in sets at the Comedy Cellar? And,
he's addicted to it. He won't stop. And... yeah, so that was like a moment that I think feels like especially timely right now too. Mm-hmm. Just like, and I just went somewhere else and did the same shit forever.
Yep,
like, awesome. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Though I do appreciate the one kid, the truth kid, who like spits on his
Larry, feminist icon Larry.
Fucking Larry wants women
when,
in office.
When Jim is like still driving on the streets after all of this has happened, yeah. He's divorced, he lost everything, he's in the car, and he sees Larry.
King
and
Larry.
They both just like lock eyes and he's like
shrug,
tries to give him a little smile and Larry's like
I'm like, yeah, Larry.
Much like what Rose does to Billy Zane in the end of Titanic.
Tooie, yeah. Where was Billy Zane in this movie? God. Where was the Babadook in this movie?
Where was Alfred Molina in this movie?
You know, there's mistake. Not everyone's always available, but I hope that I love Alfred Molina to, you know, to my dying day. I think Matthew Broderick is so good in this movie.
So well
cast.
Yeah,
he's so great.
This movie was excellently cast.
It's like a perfect inversion of who people perceive him to be. Oh, I would be remiss not to just remind everyone, as I do every time we mention Matthew Broderick. Matthew Broderick did hit two women with his car once and killed them both.
Oh my God, I didn't know that about him.
Guys, Matthew Broderick, I mean, he didn't do it on purpose.
Right.
But he was in a car with Jennifer Grey. In Ireland. And enjoy Matthew Broderick.
A manslaughterer.
It's, you know, but he was Matthew Broderick, so nothing happened.
Hmm.
Just a fun fact about Matthew Broderick, he killed the lady.
Well, that really sucks. Well, to bring
on that note.
Yeah, a fun, to uplift our spirits again after hearing that, I just wanted to point out, I don't know if anyone else noticed, but whenever you first are introduced to Paul and he's like tumbling down a mountain as he's skiing, you see two different shots of what is obviously stock footage of a skier because they're wearing different coats. And then when it cuts to a close on Paul, he's wearing a different coat from both of the previous two shots.
Hilarious.
So that's so funny.
I didn't see that.
I love that. That's
that
great.
That continuity producer
so
should be
so funny. And it's clear that they like didn't try to do, they didn't do anything to try, because they easily just could have taken the one stock footage shot and then matched
both.
The coat with whatever that person was wearing. But it seemed like an almost deliberate joke for like it to be three different coats,
because those shots are so long that
you could have just used
three.
The one. Yeah, exactly.
So, funny.
So anyway, and then finally, for anyone who's keeping track of the name anagrams of what Caitlin Durante anagrams to, relevant to this movie, Caitlin Durante anagrams to run lit candidate if you misspell candidate and only spell it with one D. So for
me,
example,
two out
you
of
know,
five.
If someone's like, hey, I don't know if I should run or not, I would say to you, run, lit candidate, because you're lit and you're a potential candidate and you should run.
Fire.
In my sub rating, I'm rating things twice an episode.
Okay.
And that's a two for me.
A two out of five?
Five.
Wow, Jamie Harsh.
Yeah, as a stretch.
No.
Listen, there's been great ones. Thank you. And I hold them to that gold standard.
Okay. I understand. Well, I think this is one of my better ones. So like, I guess we can, you know, disagree from time to time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's the one I got for this one.
The last thing I wanted to mention, to this movie's credit, this is one of the few, because we didn't discuss Jim's wife, Diane, really at all.
Right.
We're not given much other than her husband's a fucking asshole and True. She would like a baby, and she uses a sex phrase clearly written by a man, fill me up.
Oh, for
I'm
sure.
Like, what woman in her right fuck? It wouldn't happen.
Ever.
I say that every day.
No, holy shit. What if Caleb was like, I'd like to come out in strong opposition. That's my only sex phrase.
It's my campaign slogan, really, for when I, a lit candidate, run.
No!
Fill me up.
The one thing I wanted to say to that point, other than the fact that you just lost my vote, is that this is one of the rare movies where, you know, Linda tells Diane, your husband and I had sex, and Diane breaks up with her husband, doesn't seem to actively punish the other woman, which I think is usually where movies go. So I appreciated that.
Yeah. We see them having presumably just interacted and probably not passing the Bechdel test, because they're probably talking about Jim. But yeah, it seems like they are consoling each other. They're, you know, they're crying and comforting each other.
But also,
and they are placing the blame rightfully on Jim, who, I don't know if this happens right before or right after, when he has a conversation with Linda and is like, you ruined my life. And she's like, you took advantage of me. Like, and he's like, what? You took advantage of me. You kissed me. You hugged me. And like,
I think that they should have acknowledged that they both had a part in it. There was one thing where I was like, Linda was an active participant in that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that also spoke to like her not being a very well-written character, because she pretty clearly rejects him. And then all of a sudden seems not just on board to have sex with him, but on board to have sex with him in front of her baby. Which is such a leap in the character we're introduced to, that it seems like that character was sold out at some point.
Right.
But where Linda lands, she should definitely own some of the blame. But she's right. I mean, I think she's right to not, for like, obviously she didn't ruin Jim's life,
mm-hmm.
but she was an active participant. She literally fucked a guy in front of her baby. No one should do that.
Yeah. With Linda, there is no catalyst for the audience to understand why she suddenly changes her mind about wanting to sleep with Jim.
Like,
so,
why would she even invite him over after he hit on her in that way?
You would think that would put an end to that friendship.
Well, she said that she's like, I was just lonely and made a mistake. And, you know, and that's the thing again about this moral ethics. And like, it does happen. Mm-hmm. And
totally.
That's the thing I liked about this, like I like in general about this movie so much, is I think the overarching message is also about like how so much, like everything is gray. There isn't so much of like black and white, and there is a lot of gray space. And,
it does come to morals ethical versus ethics. Ambiguity.
Exactly.
Totally.
Like with every character, there's like, they're all, you could see the good side, and then you're like, oh, but you did this shitty thing. And that literally everybody.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah. Except poor Fill Me Up. She did nothing.
Hey, does this movie pass the Bechdel test?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Women do not interact nearly as much as I was expecting, considering there are a fair number of female-identifying characters.
Mm-hmm.
I only clocked one scene where it passes, which is between Tammy and Lisa in the beginning. Whenever they are kissing, Lisa pulls away. She says, I told you. And she's like, what? And she's like, it doesn't feel right anymore. And she's like, Tammy's like, but I love you. And then a few seconds later, Lisa is getting into her car and starting to drive away. And Tammy's like, where are you going? And she's like, I'm not like you. I'm not a insert homophobic slur here.
Cool pass.
We're not in love. We were just experimenting. So nothing is called into question here in terms of, hey, is a man mentioned here? Like, this is about women kissing each other. Interesting pass,
did you not have Tracy and her mom passing at least once in that scene?
Yeah. No, because unless I am just misremembering something, but the only scene I noticed where Tracy and her mom interact on screen is after Tracy finds out she loses the election, and she's crying, and then her mom comes in and she says stuff to her. Right. She's like, there, lie down, take my pill, you know? And then she's like, maybe you needed more posters or you should have taken my suggestions about your speech. But Tracy never verbally responds.
She never says anything. She's crying.
Yeah.
Bummer.
Yeah.
I wish that mom, I don't understand why that mom character wasn't more present. And that was like a weird thing for me.
So yes, this movie does pass the Bechdel test, but as far as I can tell, only in one scene, unless I'm, well, you know, missing something.
That's not okay.
That's the way the cookie crumbles.
We'll take one for 1999.
Yeah. Now we rate on our nipple scale, yay, where we rate the movie based on its portrayal of women, based on a scale of 0 to 5 nipples. This is another, like, kind of landing right in the middle for me, where to me it's not especially progressive, it's not especially regressive. It has interesting female characters. More time and care was spent to develop them, certainly more than other similar kind of teen movies, especially of this era. Mm-hmm. But also there are choices that were made, like the statutory affair that happens between the teacher and the student. And
yeah.
I don't know. This is just like...
It's a hard one.
It's a hard... This is a hard one. This is... Some of them are very easy, and this is a hard one because, as you were kind of touching on, Natasha, it's like... There's a lot of ambiguity and gray area that is honestly very realistic.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
we
very
as people find ourselves having to make difficult decisions and being faced with things that we don't exactly know what the right and moral and ethical thing to do is in the moment, and maybe making mistakes here and there. So I think all of those aspects of the film are interesting. Worth noting that this is an extremely white movie.
Yes.
That could be maybe explained away the fact that this takes place in a suburb of Omaha, where
I'm sure there are people of color.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But
even one or two, we're everywhere.
Yeah,
right. At least the Indians. I'm sure we found our way somewhere over there. It's a billion.
But yeah, every major speaking role, in fact, maybe even every speaking role, period, is spoken by a white person.
Yes.
I do appreciate that there is clear and not coded, because if there is queer characters in movies, usually they're just coded that way. But we do see someone who, even though she perhaps is not totally sure how she identifies at this stage in her life, she
openly
is
queer.
Yeah. Although, as we discussed, you know, she kind of falls into a sort of tropey character of, like, kind of the angry lesbian type.
Yeah.
So, you know, more care and time could have been spent to develop these characters just a little bit more. Yeah. So, overall, this was a very long-winded way to say that I give this movie... I'm going to give this movie, I think, 2.5 nips. I'll give one to Tracy Flick. I'll give one to Tammy. And I will give my remaining half nipple to Diane, Jim's wife and then ex-wife. Because I feel like we should have...
His wife.
Because I feel like we should have learned more about her. And more about the mom character. More about many characters. But, you know, you only have so much time in a movie. So
I'm very close to wanting to do a 3.5 for this one. Natasha, you made a great point at the end for all the, like, nitpicky things I have about this movie. By and large, every character in this movie is presented as flawed. And that is, I think, in general, a positive in that we have female characters that we know well enough to know that they're flawed.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's the only thing we know about them, or we know nothing at all.
Yes.
So where I do have, like, certain, like, thoughts of, like, I think that Tammy's character could have been handled better. You're totally right. She's a very flawed character, as is the entire main cast. And for any criticism of, like, everyone, like, it's not just the female identifying characters in this movie that end where they started. Everyone's in a vicious cycle that they made themselves. And that's, you know, depressing, but feels real, and at least is uniformly applied to almost every character. You know, there are a few misses with, I absolutely agree that the statutory rape storyline is mishandled, and there's, I mean, I think that there's space inside of it, this movie, for it to be handled well, mm-hmm. but it's not. And then there's a few Uncanny Valley characters like Linda where I could understand where you're coming from, but we just haven't spent enough time with you to understand
sure.
why these sudden switches were made. And just the I don't see any reason why Tracy's mom couldn't have been more present. Mm-hmm. Little stuff like that. Obviously, it is a very white movie. And there's no reason in a high school setting for their, you know.
Although my high school had 99.9% white people in it, so I don't totally. Like... Not to defend this choice at all, sure. but it might be a regional thing. Who knows? But also in movies, you can make choices to, you know, misrepresent right. things because movies do it all the time.
Right. And also but, it's like, how would it have affected the story negatively? Like it would.
Sure. Yeah.
It wouldn't. You know, you could have the movie happen the exact same way and have included people of color at any point. But I'll go three and a half because it's hard to find. It's hard to find complicated depictions of women in movies at all. Mm-hmm. And we've got a few here.
Yeah.
And I really, really enjoyed this movie. And I'm looking forward to seeing it again. What I was going to say is not just a complicated woman in 1999, but the kind of character you can keep revisiting and take something new away every time. I think that that is something very commonly applied to male characters.
Mm-hmm.
I go right to TV, but like, you know, your Don Drapers of like revisiting this guy we all thought was so fucking cool. There's not a lot of female characters that are written well enough to be able to go back and have new takeaways.
For sure.
So I'll go 3.5. I'm going to give 2 to Tracy Flick, and I give that half to Diane, and I'm giving the last to that poor baby who had to see Matthew Broderick have sex.
You guys said everything. No. I would give it 3, also because I appreciate that they were telling a female sort of driven story. I appreciate that there were multiple female characters. I mean, we talked about, 5 or so in mm-hmm. it, you know. The reason I wouldn't give it a full 5 is because they were portrayed to be like the parts of us that could be embraced were sort of underappreciated. So even in the, and I get it. I mean, as a writer, like mm-hmm. when you're writing a character, you just got to go like, all in. You can't be like, oh, the you know, the ambitious student, and the log line has to be the over ambitious student, the
right.
obnoxious student. Like it has to do, and I get it, but I wish that, you know, if we had the platform, we weren't portrayed as that. Otherwise, I feel like all your points are valid. I'm always an advocate for diversity. That said, I completely get that I'm from Canada, and I think it's a lot more common there to see all sorts of people. But I've learned as I've come to America that there are cities here where people didn't have people of color at all, like until college and stuff. Mm. So yeah. I understand that, and I'm just kidding sometimes, sometimes not. that everybody should have diversity. But it's, you know, back, it was fucking 1999. It's all good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so 3. I'll give 2.5 to Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
Just because she's a ball buster.
Yeah.
And she, you know, didn't let anybody stop her. And she had a lot of shit happen to her, and she pushed on. She was also a human being who was flawed, and I think there's a lot to take away from her. And fucking Reese Witherspoon plays her, so you have to love her.
Hell yeah.
The other quarters I'll give to Tammy, because like you said, it's great that they had an openly queer character on camera, and her depiction was honest in the beginning of her struggling, you know, and trying to figure it out. Diane, yeah. I feel bad for her.
Yeah.
I feel bad for her. And so I don't think the math added up, guys. Don't judge me. I'm Indian. I should have known the math, but I didn't.
I think that, I no, didn't that, add it that up. Tried, yeah. I did.
I'm also half 3. Hungover, but I'm not. I'm just really sleepy.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having
me. It's been so much fun. What would you like to plug? Where can people find you online?
Oh, yeah. You guys can check out the Kinda Dating podcast. We are everywhere you find podcasts, and we're also on YouTube. You can follow us on social media. We're at Kinda Dating across the board. I'm at Natasha Chandel on Facebook and Instagram and Natasha_Chandel on Twitter. Because some other bitch took my name. No, I'm kidding.
Unbelievable.
Who never uses Twitter. Give me my handle back. No, I'm kidding.
Awesome. You can follow the Bechdel Cast on the various platforms on Twitter and Instagram at Bechdel Cast. You can rate and review us on iTunes. You can subscribe to our Patreon, aka our Matreon, by going to patreon.com/Bechdelcast, and you pay $5 and you get two bonus episodes every single month.
It's November, so you're going to be thankful
for
that you did. Oh, and also don't forget, you can, now that we're getting into holiday season, you can also gift someone else a Patreon subscription. We had some of that last year. Also, last year on Thanksgiving, fun November fact, Caitlin and I got violently drunk and watched every version of The Grinch ever made.
And also watched and recorded an as still unreleased Titanic episode.
Because we were too drunk.
Yeah.
So all that to say, we put a lot of love and care into the Patreon. And if we are too drunk, we will not release it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless, I don't know, maybe the...
it's funny.
We've gotten requests for like, when are you releasing this? I think the people might want it. We'll see.
If some of our listeners wanted to donate substantially to an organization we love, they can hear and we'll just hope they don't assange it and just keep it to themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, you can go to our merch store.
Gift season.
tpublic.com/TheBechdelCast and buy all of our goodies there.
Holiday shopping. We'll be introducing some new designs in November. So get ready for, Cyber Monday. Cyber Monday. Okay, we love you so much.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye-bye. Vote.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shankar, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage. A 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.